The Alliance of Confessing Evangelicals is pleased to bring you the following message from the Philadelphia Conference on Reformed Theology. Since its start in 1974, this conference has attracted audiences to its biblical expository approach to Christian doctrine. The Alliance is a listener-supported ministry. Our purpose is to promote a biblical understanding and worldview.
Well, I think I'd much rather have been given the topic of atonement, possibly in the medieval period. Consider the work, say, of Anselm of Canterbury or Abelard, from whose theological writings we get the categories of satisfaction and substitution when it comes to an understanding of the penal nature of Christ's redemptive work for us. Of course, I'd love to talk about Calvin's doctrine of the atonement, having spent many years in studies in Calvin. Would love to be with Joel Beakey, listening to the Puritans and their emphasis on the blood of Christ. The extraordinary emphasis given to the atonement, for example, in 18th and 19th century hymnody that comes out of the Second Great Awakening. Many of those lines, Charles Wesley, Toplady, Isaac Watts, Newton, and so on, so full of references to the atonement in terms of categories that we are very familiar with. But the early church, well, what is the early church? At first I thought I would cheat. The early church is the church in the Acts of the Apostles. Paul's doctrine of the atonement, that would go well. One could look at many beautiful passages that one can think of in the epistles, for example, and tease out a doctrine of the atonement. That would be a lot of fun. But I don't think that's what the organizers, and really there's only one, of course, Rick is the czar of this conference, and I have teased him one time too many, and I got the early church. I teach an elective at the seminary on what we sometimes call patristic theology, and it has long since come to my understanding that even theological seminary students are largely unfamiliar with the subtle nuances of what we sometimes call the church fathers. And there's just a sort of fog, really, from the death of the apostles around 100 AD or so to the rise of Augustine. They're aware of certain great events, of course, Chalcedon, Nicaea, Constantinople, some of the great debates on the incarnation, the person of Christ, the doctrine of the Trinity especially, and some other things. But the doctrine of the atonement in the early church or the church fathers or in patristic theology, and that's basically what I'm going to be focusing on. We're talking about the period of history from, say, 120 AD until 600, from the apologists of the second century through to the death of Augustine. Now, there's no doubt that many of the categories of theology, for good or ill, come from Augustine. Augustine is the great figure of church history. There is no way that you can underestimate the influence of Augustine, both on the Western church, whether that be Catholicism or Protestantism. And one remembers, of course, Warfield's statement about Augustine, that the triumph of the doctrine of grace over his doctrine of the church. Thank God for grace in Augustine, or we would be in trouble. But even in the Eastern Church, and we are still today largely unaware, most of us, of the Eastern tradition. It is a rising tradition. It's one that's influencing even the circles that we move in. Some well-known figures have moved into Eastern Orthodoxy. It is including, of course, folks like Schaeffer's son and others. What is it that separates the Western Church and the Eastern Church? Huge tradition of theology and ecclesiology in Greek, in the Greek Orthodoxy, or say in the, for want of a generalization, Russian Orthodoxy. And since the breakup of the Soviet Union, the various strands of Orthodoxy that again have reared their heads, and we see them more and more. On the cusp of, say, more liberal theology, and again I'm speaking in generalities now, the study of Eastern Orthodoxy, including one of the issues that I want to take up, is very much on the agenda. It's no longer seen as a division over the procession of the Holy Spirit, but on issues that are far greater than that. Well, in the patristic era, I think it's true to say that the concept of God is expressed more or less organically using a variety of biblical metaphors without stressing one in particular. Now, that statement maybe is too complex, so let me tease that apart a little, and let me ask some questions around that statement that I've just made, because a part of the issue that's before us is a more general one as to the development of Christian doctrine per se. The Bible doesn't give us Burkhoff's systematic theology. It's not there in the appendix after Revelation. Whatever study Bible you're using, it's not part of divine revelation, of course, even if it does bear the name of Ryrie or someone else. How does doctrine develop, and what is doctrine? Our forefathers would have referred to it by the term dogma, which is almost anathema now. The very sound of that word, dogma, dogmatics. I teach dogmatics, or at least had I taught it 100 years ago, I would have been teaching dogmatics. I now teach systematic theology, but it's the same thing that's being taught, of course. What is dogma, and how does one get from Bible to an ecumenical creed like Chalcedon, like the Niceno-Constantinopolitan creed, to a confession? And what is a confession, and how is it different from an ecumenical creed, like the Westminster Confession, the confession, or or the Belgic Confession? And of course, in a simplistic way, the confessions, of course, are bound by geographical boundaries, and they're bound by denominational boundaries, even though the Westminster Confession was represented by Presbyterians and by Anglicans and by Independents. The 1689 Baptist Confession was, of course, Baptist, and the Savoy Declaration were purely Congregationalist and largely John Owen. But the ecumenical councils of Chalcedon or the Niceno-Constantinopolitan Creed, the calling of some of these councils, the way in which Constantine drew 220 bishops together from across the empire, though largely from the eastern side of the empire, to be honest. How do we move from Bible to dogma, to doctrine? Why doesn't Paul or Peter or John give us something more like a confessional statement of doctrine? Would the Apostle Paul recognize the Westminster Confession of Faith? Would he recognize the Apostles' Creed? He's more likely to have recognized the Apostles' Creed than the Westminster Confession of Faith, to be sure, just by saying that the Apostles' Creed is that much simpler in shape and style. Well, one of the great scholars that's done an enormous amount of work in this area, and I should put it in the past tense now because he's just recently died, and he died and not passed away, and that is Yaroslav Pelikan. And whilst I'm not suggesting for 1 minute that I agree with everything that Yaroslav Pelikan has written, and I don't, his monumental study called Credo in several volumes that only libraries could ever afford to buy, to be honest, and maybe Rick Phillips, that has studied the progress of Christian doctrine. It's a fascinating issue. How do we get from the Bible to a statement of doctrine that binds us together in conscience as an expression of biblical truth? Well, that issue isn't one that's been settled, of course, and there are still debates between what we might call biblical theologians and systematic theologians, because biblical theologians suspect that from Bible to dogma, from Bible to doctrine, has come in various ingredients which shouldn't be there, like philosophy, like logic, like Aristotelianism, like Ramist philosophy, if it's the Westminster Confession. So there are all kinds of difficulties, tensions, suspicions as to the influences in moving from Bible statements, Bible words, Bible verses, a more, and let me use a term now without intending disparagement as such, but simply a term that some of you will recognize, moving from something that's more symphonic, right? Some of you are recognizing that buzz term that moves around in our circles, moving from something that's more symphonic, like a piece by Debussy or Maurice Ravel. Some of you, not many, are nodding in that way. Something that's a thought here and a thought there, but no idea of cohesion, no idea of bringing it together into one. That there are various ways, multiple ways of saying the same thing. Multiple metaphors, multiple pictures can be utilized in expressing a doctrine. Well, that's a fascinating topic. We could go with it now for a while. I'd be going away from my assigned topic, which I'm tempted to do. But you understand, why is it really that there is no ecumenical council or creedal pronouncement on the atonement? There isn't really one in the Apostles' Creed. It merely states that Jesus died under Pontius Pilate, was crucified, dead, and buried, and on the third day he rose again. Well, that's, of course, probably alluding to the statement of 1 Corinthians 15, I delivered unto you first of all. Now, let's remember those words, and I'll come back to them in a second, that Christ died and rose again. I mean, that's Paul saying that there are doctrines, there are truths that are first of all, and by implication, there are truths that are second of all. There are primary truths and there are secondary truths. I think in this room, we would agree, maybe with some variation, that the mode of baptism is a secondary truth. Now, some of you might not agree with that, but that's where I would be. But when it comes to good order within the church, I then move into the point of view that says that a confession ought to have some statement about mode of baptism. Otherwise, we're going to have a lot of anarchy on our hands. But it doesn't, it's not a disfellowshipping doctrine, like if somebody denies the Trinity or if somebody has a false view of the atonement, then I have to break fellowship. There comes a point where whatever it is you believe, it's not Christian truth that you believe. Now, that issue is fascinating for a whole variety of reasons, but we don't really get statements about the atonement in creedal form until the Reformation, until the great confessions of the 16th and 17th century. The ecumenical creeds are largely creeds about the person of Christ. They occasionally allude to the work of Christ, but they're not as such creedal statements on the work of Christ. They're on the person of Christ, and in particular on the doctrine of the Trinity. It's an interesting observation, maybe a disturbing observation, that it takes 1,500 years before the church gets the atonement right. That would be a simplistic conclusion to draw, of course, because one of the things I want to try and say to you is that really penal substitution and its attendant categories has in fact been believed since the early church, but it hasn't been formulated as Christian doctrine by which the church stands or falls until the 16th or 17th century. Now, why does God wait that long in his providence to get the doctrine of the atonement? We'd all agree that's not a secondary doctrine, it's a primary doctrine. What is our understanding of the death of Jesus? Why does he take 1,500 years for the church to get that right, or at least to creedally formulate it? And I have no answer for that. That's one of the extraordinary mysteries of providence. Part of the answer is that truth is often formulated in creedal statements in opposition to error. There's a context in which these things take place. In the early church, the discussions were largely on the deity of Jesus or the humanity of Jesus. Some denying his humanity, some denying his deity, and those who affirmed both were confused about the relationship of the humanity and deity of Jesus. And that largely dominates the 3rd and 4th and even 5th centuries. Well, in the 2nd century, we're talking about 120 through 200, that kind of period, the issue that dominates the early church, of course, is the Gnostic issue, when the whole involvement of God with creation, the relationship of spirit to matter, was called into question. You have Marcion and some Gnostics, in particular, jettisoning the entirety of the Old Testament as being sub-Christian, and bits of the New Testament, like Matthew, being too Jewish in its nature. And early Christian writers are mesmerized, therefore, by Genesis 1, 2, and 3, and especially by the fall. So a lot of the apologists, for example, are dealing with largely Gnosticism on the one hand, or the Marcionite tendency on the other, to such an extent that what emerges, I think, in the second century is a view of salvation that largely is seen as a threefold dynamic, that God sent prophets, first of all, to instruct, that God gave Old Testament worship to make them, Israel, that is, stand out to the nations, and then to emphasize the importance of the incarnation as the culmination of all that the Old Testament and God's dealings with Israel was largely looking towards: the coming of Messiah, the coming of Jesus, the coming of the covenant mediator. So the whole concern then is largely on the identity of who is Jesus and what is Jesus and his Jewishness and what is new about the new covenant and what is the relationship between that newness and the old covenant. Now, several broad themes appear, and I want to mention four or five of them, and then I want to look at some of them in detail. But let me just mention the themes that emerge. And the first one I think that we can identify is the theme that Christ's work was essentially ethical and pedagogical, that he was a teacher, that he was an example, that he'd come to typify for us godliness. He'd come to typify for us obedience to God's law. And in the early centuries, the example of Christ, Christ as the example, as the great exemplar, particularly in the light of discussions in Greek philosophy, and particularly Plato and Aristotle, the whole issue in ethics of the godly life and what it means, and Christ being the pinnacle of the godly life. And there's truth in that, of course. One can readily imagine in the early church, particularly when there is no Bible, people don't have a New Testament. They don't have copies of it. They don't have an ESV. They don't have the NIV. They certainly don't have the King James Bible. And they are largely dependent on what's called anamnesis. They're largely dependent on memory, on catechesis, on what they've been taught and instructed and catechized. And Christ as the great example, then, Christ as the great leader, Christ as the example to follow. Come, follow me. So that in a sense, the gospel then becomes the new law. And for those with Marcionite tendencies, the new law in opposition to Old Testament law. So that the Christian church then had to defend itself, in particular, against, by the second century, against not just coexistence with Judaism, but in opposition now to Judaism. This is a long time before Constantine, and in the second century, the church has to emerge and defend itself now in opposition to growing hostility on behalf of Judaism. Christ as the great teacher and Christ as the great example. The second broad theme that appears is the recognition of the centrality of the cross, the recognition of the centrality of the cross. And here, especially, I want to mention, in particular, Irenaeus. Irenaeus is the great bishop of Gaul, of Lyon, France. And Irenaeus's view here that has about it, we refer to it these days by the term, the recapitulation theory of the atonement. There are many aspects of this view of the atonement that are biblical and with which we find, in an orthodox expression of the atonement, we find resonating notes. In simplistic forms, Irenaeus is emphasizing Jesus as a second Adam, that he came to repair, to repeat, to recapitulate. Think of musicians and sonata form, and you have recapitulation, a restatement of a theme now in a way that resolves, in a way that does what Adam did not do. So Irenaeus especially spoke of Christ repairing Adam's disobedience. This is one of his statements. The tree of Adam's disobedience was repaired by the tree of Christ's obedience. And the tree, of course, is the cross. So the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, that's the tree of disobedience, and the cross is the tree of obedience. And he's picking up these metaphors. Sounds like he's a biblical theologian doing sort of symphonic theology a little. Here's a tree, and these two must relate to each other in some way. Now, we would readily admit that that's a perfectly biblical thought. We would put it in slightly more federalistic terms than that. Now, we would want to see more legal structures and character to that. What is it that Christ is obeying? Law. That Christ is obeying a covenant of works, right? Language which belongs in the 16th century and maybe even in the 17th century, late 16th, early 17th century, not in the period of Irenaeus. Well, for Irenaeus, the high point then in salvation history is the advent of Jesus. That Irenaeus believes that Christ would always have been sent, even if humanity had not sinned. But the fact that they did sin determines his role as a savior. So he sees Christ then as a new Adam who systematically undoes what Adam did. Where Adam was disobedient concerning God's edict then of the fruit of the tree of knowledge, Christ was obedient even to death on the wood of a tree. Irenaeus is the first to draw comparisons between Eve and Mary, the seed of the woman. Why does Jesus in the wedding at Cana in Galilee in John chapter 2 say to his mother, "Woman, what have I to do with you?" Now, you never ever call your mother woman. Don't even think about it. It would be enormously disrespectful in almost any society to refer to your mother as woman. In Mississippi, she is ma'am, and your father is sir. Why does he call her woman? Because I think he's alluding to Genesis and the Mosaic word about the seed of the woman. He is the seed of the woman. Is he the seed of Mary? Or is he the seed of Eve? The original promise, the Proto-Evangelium. Well, of course, there's an element of that, of course, then, which is true. Christ's example, Christ as the second Adam, emerging in the second century. The third broad stroke category is the payment of a ransom price. The payment of a ransom price. And I'll just mention it here and then expound on it a little more in detail in a few minutes. But to whom is the ransom price paid? I came not to be served, but to serve and to give my life a ransom for many. Mark 10:45. There seems no doubt that in the early church, and maybe even in the late first century, that text circulated among Christians. It was one of those encapsulating texts. It was a crystallizing text. You can imagine as Christian folk met together without a New Testament, before the New Testament had been finished and before copies of it had been carefully copied and multiplied in the Roman Empire, that these would be the kinds of things that they would remember. That Jesus had said he had come to give his life as a ransom for many. Well, who do you pay ransoms to? To bad people. To thieves, to murderers, to terrorists. Governments agonize. They always deny it, but I'm pretty sure they end up doing it. British government was up to its neck in paying ransoms in Ireland in the time I was there. They always denied it publicly, of course, because it encouraged more kidnappings. But there's no doubt but that these large sums of money are paid. But to whom are they paid? They are paid to bad people. Well, to whom did Jesus pay a ransom? Well, of course, the orthodox and biblical answer that you and I ought to say is to God. That God needs to be propitiated. His justice needs to be met. Well, in the second century, the view developed that this ransom, of course, is paid to the devil. He is the archetypal bad person here. And from which there develops a fairly pronounced view of the atonement that would largely dominate the early church, right up until the period of Augustine, the so-called Christus Victor view of the atonement. More recently, it has been popularized and written about by Gustav Aulen. It's a century ago now. It's at the turn of the 19th, 20th century. Gustav Aulen wrote a book called Christus Victor. It was a study and an analysis of the doctrine of Christus Victor in the early church. Now I'll have something to say about that in a minute. It was largely overturned, I think, in the medieval period by the social structure of the medieval period with its feudalism and so on, that more legal categories of the atonement come to the fore. Well, the fourth area, and these are just broad themes, Christ as example, Christ as the second Adam, Christ as a ransom, the death of Christ, the cross, as a ransom paid to the devil. And fourthly, and largely, and almost exclusively in the East, the view known as, and I'm going to have to use a technical term now, theosis. And allow me just for a second to translate that. Some of you may be scholars in theosis. I hope not, or I'm leaving now. It's an enormously complex area. But if I say it means divinization, I am fully aware that my Greek Orthodox friends, and I don't really have any, but if I had Greek Orthodox friends, they would immediately protest and say unfair. But I think a literal rendition of theosis is divinization. And it's largely based on the text of 2 Peter 1 and verse 4, that we are made partakers of the divine nature. Now, if you've not read 2 Peter 1, 4 recently, you may wonder if that's actually in the Bible or that an apostle actually wrote those words, but I assure you they are there. We are made partakers of the divine nature. Well, it's one of those texts that is surrounded by 1,000 pitfalls. You move and you're probably doomed. You can state the words exactly as Peter writes them without any degree of explanation, but the moment you begin to explain, you're on the edge and on the cusp of a heresy. Are we made divine by being regenerate, by being regenerated? Are we in union with Christ, ourselves part of God? Are we sharing, which it looks as if that's what Peter is saying, that we are sharing in the divine nature of God? In what sense? In an ontological sense, in the sense of being? Are we part then of the divine? No, there have been movements in our own century. Well, I mean, the 20th century. I think of Pannenberg, for example, as one of the great liberal voices of the late 20th century, who essentially advocated a view similar to that, a pantheistic view, that God shall be all in all. That enigmatic statement of Paul at the end of 1 Corinthians 15, that God shall be all in all. That, in other words, everything in the end becomes an extension of God. Well, clearly, in our Reformed world, we want to make the distinction between God and creation, the creator-creature distinction. That's not just a momentary thing. It's not something for this space and time, but that's an eternal distinction. There is God and there is creation. But Peter says we are made partakers of the divine nature. And from that, there develops then this view. Irenaeus, again, would be associated with that, along with a whole host of people. Athanasius. We love Athanasius. Athanasius is one of our heroes. Athanasius contra mundum, against the world. Athanasius against Arius. Athanasius was a bully. He was a political bully. He did not think twice about torturing people who were heretics. You would not want to cross Athanasius. We love him for his defense of homoousios and for his invention of the term homoousios. Is Christ like God, or is Christ of the same being and nature as God? And the only difference in Greek between those two, there's the world of difference between those two, is he like God? Is he God-like, or is he God? Homoousios and homoousios. And there is only one letter of a difference. It's where we get the expression, not an iota of a difference. The Arians said there's not an iota of a difference between this. And Athanasius insisted there was a world of difference between these two. One means that Christ can save us. Another means that Christ is doomed like the rest of us. Well, we uphold, revere Athanasius, but Athanasius' view of the atonement, as opposed to his view of the person of Christ, his view of the atonement was theosis. Athanasius uttered and wrote those extraordinary words in De Incarnatione, on the incarnation. God became like man to be one of us in order that man might become God. Now, it's as bold as that. It is really as bold as that, Athanasius says. Now, you have to understand it within its context. You have to understand it within the context of the early church as to what Athanasius is saying and what he's not saying. But the idea of theosis, of, and I'm going to call it for now, divinization, that in some form or another, and there are variations, considerable variations between various of the church fathers as to what that actually means. But that language, which would be common language today in Orthodox circles, I don't mean Orthodox meaning Calvinists, I mean Orthodox meaning Eastern Orthodox. I don't know how many of you have ever attended an Eastern Orthodox service or tried, as I did one time, to speak to an Eastern Orthodox cleric. They don't think like we do. They don't think in rational, logical sequences of thought. Now, I've long since come to realize that many of my students don't think like that anymore either. But the tradition of the West certainly is to think in logical sequence of thought. If you're in the East, that's not the way they think. So what may appear to you as a blatant contradiction is not to them. And understanding and appreciating that is, of course, important in apologetics. Now, let's delve a little into some of these views. And let me go back to the recapitulation view, of Irenaeus, the Bishop of Lyon, one of the great figures, of course, in the early church. In his, perhaps his magnum opus, and he wrote a great deal, but in his magnum opus against heresies, he speaks of Christ uniting himself with us in the incarnation in order that we might become what he is. He unites himself with us in order that we might become what he is. In the incarnation, he united himself to humanity and so attaches humanity to God. And for Irenaeus, the great issue then is the likeness and parallel with Adam. The likeness and the parallel with Adam. Irenaeus sees the work of Christ against a background of dualism. These views overlap. By dualism, I mean the almost equal power of God and Satan, of good and evil. Adam had lost that battle. Jesus wins that battle. It is the obedience of Christ for Irenaeus that is crucial and central. He wins the victory by being obedient. The recapitulation theory and the ransom theory overlap. In the ransom theory, and it's held by Origen, the man to whom we often attribute typology, and I mean excessive typology in the scriptures, but also to a whole host of Gregory of Nyssa, Gregory of Nazianzen, and others. There is this ethical dualism, God and Satan, good and evil. The devil holds humanity in his grasp, demanding a ransom price, and the ransom price is the death of Jesus. And Jesus agrees, or the Father agrees, to pay this ransom price, and the devil kills him on the cross. But then, like a Trojan horse, from inside there emerges the resurrected Christ, and Satan has been duped. He thinks he's won. He thinks he's triumphed. He thinks he's gotten the victory. But all along, He was duped because inside the Trojan horse of the body of Jesus, there is his spirit. There is his divine nature that Satan had not bargained for. Now, important, of course, to the ransom theory is the divine nature of Jesus, whether that divine nature is part of his being or whether that divine nature is something that is adopted by an earthly Jesus. And they're not all agreed. They're not all orthodox on that issue. But it's the idea of paying a ransom price to the devil. Now, the language that emerges out of that ransom theory is Christus Victor, Christ as the victorious one, Christ as the conquering military hero that comes back from a famous battle against a hostile and powerful enemy. Now, we hear a great deal in our own time about Christus Victor. It's very popular now. Lots of sermons and preachers in our circles will often use the term Christus Victor. I use it. You have to use it with enormous care. You have to use it in a way that the church fathers did not use it. Right? You may use the term, but you're not meaning the same thing as the church fathers meant by it. Because we don't believe in dualism. We believe that Satan is a finite being. He is a more malevolent being than you and I can ever imagine, but he's a finite being. He cannot be in two places at the same time. So when we think that Satan is attacking us, he may well be attacking a believer in India, as far as you know, because he cannot be in two places at the same time. He has a host of minions that do his work. He has limited power. He has enormous power, but he has limited power. It doesn't equal the power of God. It doesn't equal the sovereignty of God. So our view of the atonement, see, a dualistic view of the atonement is almost bound to set Satan and God on equal terms. In a hair-raising battle, the outcome of which may be uncertain until it happens. The problem with the ransom theory is that at the very heart of it, it involves deception. It involves a lie. Now, we can argue the ethics of, is it right to tell lies in times of war? Well, somebody's saying no, but there are others probably in this room who would say yes. When the Nazis are at the door and you've got a Jew up in the attic and they're saying, do you have any Jews in the house? I'm not about to take sides here as to what you say. It's a strong man or woman that says, yes, I have, and he's up in the attic because I can't lie here. That's an enormously difficult position to take. Now, don't want to get sidetracked on that conundrum in ethics. It's the Hebrew midwives, of course, the same issue. Were they telling lies? Or as some commentators, Hebrew commentators argue, that actually they were telling the truth, that they did deliver before they got there. That's probably not the view that I take, but whatever. The problem with the ransom theory is it involves at its very core deception. Now, you may say it's okay to deceive the devil. I mean, what does he deserve? But it is a difficult view of the atoning work of a just, righteous God that at the heart of it, there lies deception. And that's why Christus Victor fell out of favor, the classic doctrine of Christus Victor. Now, I'm not denying that Jesus is a victor. I'm not denying that he has entered into battle against and bound the strong man, to use the language of Scripture, made a triumph of the evil forces openly triumphing over them in the cross, as Paul says in Colossians. That imagery is certainly there in the New Testament. We wrestle not against flesh and blood, but against principalities and powers. And the language principalities and powers arraigned against the forces of God and goodness and so on is all over the pages of the New Testament. But it's not in a dualistic way. It's not dualism. It's there in Genesis and it's there in Revelation. The slithering serpent in Genesis is the great red dragon in Revelation 12. So it is a theme of the atonement. It is an aspect of the atonement. God is involved in a battle against the forces of darkness and opposition. But is it the main feature of the atonement. To whom is that ransom paid? Who is it that needs to be satisfied? God. God's justice. Now, it takes the medieval period. It takes a feudal system of law for that to be embedded within Christian consciousness. The propriety of law and the structures of a legal system that actually operate within the atonement itself, that God may be just and the justifier of him who believes in Jesus. And so in Anselm of Canterbury and Abelard and others, you see the emergence then of categories, not biblical words, like Trinity isn't a biblical word, of satisfaction and substitution. Now, we think of both of those terms as absolutely crucial to an understanding of the atonement. I thank God for penal substitution, that Christ satisfies the demands of law and justice in my place. Then there's the view of theosis. Let me come back to this again. Ephrion, a 4th century Syrian poet, a writer of hymns, Armenian, not Arminian, but Armenian hymns. Now, Microsoft Word, Bill Gates does not know the word Arminian because spell checker in Microsoft Word always changes Arminian into Armenian. So papers that I get from my students, they always have these racial slurs about Armenians. Right, so when you get your copy of Microsoft Word, you need to go into the spell checker dictionary thing and add Arminian, right? So you don't get this racial thing going on. Anyway, Ephrem, a 4th century Syrian poet. Now, this is his piece of poetry. And it's about a bird that grows up in three stages. A bird grows up in three stages. Now, the poetry is not good in English, you understand. It's just a translation. A bird grows up in three stages, from womb to egg, then to the nest where it sings. And once it is fully grown, it flies in the air, opening its wings in the symbol of the cross. Now, that brings tears to your eyes, that beautiful piece of poetry. And you say, you know, Starbucks folks who sit around Starbucks and drink coffee all day long, especially in California, well, we talk about poetry, you know, may get a warm glow and a wonderful feeling. Isn't that a beautiful thing? But it's actually classic theosis. You grow and take flight and you emerge into something far bigger and far greater than you ever imagined it to be. God becomes like us. He became man so that we might become God. Now, Athanasius said that. Now, what does he mean by that? We are sharers in the divine nature. Now, a lot of liberal commentators on Peter, of course, they deny that Peter wrote it to begin with, but a lot of liberal commentators on Peter speak here of the relapse in the second century, and they believe this document is second century, not first century. They speak of this relapse into Hellenistic dualism. This is just a relapse into the kind of Greek philosophy that was prevalent in the first century BC and through the first century. And they now say that Peter, or whoever wrote 2 Peter chapter 1, has relapsed into that Hellenistic dualism. We are sharers in the divine nature. Read Calvin on 2 Peter 1, 4 sometime. Hold on to your britches. He comes right to the edge. I have no idea what Calvin means, and I'm not persuaded that he wants us to know fully what he means. I think he's using language there in his commentary on 2 Peter 1:4. It's extremely edgy what he's saying. We are partakers of the divine nature. Now, of course, orthodoxy will demand that it cannot possibly be understood in an ontological sense, that our being doesn't become divine. We're not absorbed into the great force of the universe. I know there are folk in California who talk like that, but that's not 2 Peter 1:4. What is 2 Peter 1:4 saying? We are brought into union with Christ, a federal union, a legal union, in which we share in certain things. There are attributes of God that are communicable, as well as attributes of God that are incommunicable. We begin to love like we've never loved before. We begin to display acts of righteousness that we never had before. They are God-like attributes. They are divine-like attributes. They are Jesus-like attributes. We are sharing in the divine nature. Very carefully interpreted, so that we're not straying into ontological categories. Now, in the early church, it has to be said that that was not at all clear. What about the view of penal substitution? And let me close with this thought. Because sometimes we present, just as we present justification by faith as suddenly, you know, emerging in 1517 when Luther nails the 95 Theses to the door of Wittenberg Castle, and all of a sudden justification by faith that hadn't been known for 1,000 years since Augustine is suddenly on the map. Well, of course, that's a travesty of church history. Now, there were, to be sure, accounts of the Reformation in the past written along those lines, but it's long since been seen as a travesty of the medieval period. And there were large aspects of the medieval period that the reformers did not change at all. Now, just as you can trace justification by faith alone back into Huss and the Hussites and others, so you can trace penal substitution. You can certainly trace it back to Abelard and some of Canterbury, but you can trace it all the way back to the church fathers. Now, the book, Pierced for Our Transgressions, it's enormously interesting. Pierced for Our Transgressions. It's been written, of course, with the intent of dismantling and destroying the view that is now current in certain evangelical quarters that penal substitution is divine cosmic child abuse. What father would treat his son in that way? The very theory of it is wrong and new and novel, and something that emerges in the nasty, mean-spirited, insular, sectarian world of the 16th century. And the whole point of the Pierced for Our Transgressions is to see satisfaction and substitution as having roots all the way back in the church fathers. Let me cite to you just one interesting quotation from Chrysostom. Chrysostom, in his homilies, one of the great preachers, of course, of the early church. And it's amazing, absolutely amazing, that we have so many hundreds of his sermons that he preached. Enormously, enormously gifted preacher. His sermons on John, for example, or his sermons on Corinthians are staggering. Here's a sermon, and he's preaching it on 2 Corinthians. You can find it, of course, in the Nicene and post-Nicene fathers. Those of you know what I'm talking about. If one that was himself a king, beholding a robber and malefactor under punishment, gave his well-beloved son, his only begotten and true, to be slain, and transferred the death and the guilt as well from him to his son, who was himself of no such character, that he might both save the condemned man and clear him from his evil reputation. And then if, having subsequently promoted him to great dignity, he had yet, after thus saving him and advancing him to that glory unspeakable, been outraged by the person that had received such treatment, would not that man, if he had any sense, have chosen 10,000 deaths rather than appear guilty of so great ingratitude? This, then, let us also now consider with ourselves, and groan bitterly for the provocation we have offered our benefactor. Nor let us therefore presume, because though outraged, he bears it with long suffering. But rather, for this very reason, be full of remorse. Well, that's Chrysostom. The translation, of course, may be a little awkward, but the point is, that's penal substitution. That could come out of Anselm of Canterbury. And that could be a Puritan. And this is one of the church fathers. So the language of penal substitution is certainly there in the early church, but it was only one of many ways of trying to describe what the death of Jesus was about. Within the recapitulation theory, or within the ransom theory, or even within the theosis theory, there were strands of truth. Some emphasized one aspect more than others, but there is an antiquity to the multifaceted nature of the death of Jesus that we think of in terms of penal substitution, of satisfaction and substitution, but also in terms of victory over the evil one, in terms of bringing us into union and fellowship with God, whereby we share in his communicable attributes. We share in his glory. We shall behold the glory. We shall be glorified. The glory of God shines in and through us. Christ is the second Adam. He is the last man, because there is no need for another. He undoes what Adam did by being obedient to the demands of covenant obligation. And all of those themes are biblical themes of the atonement. Now, we would categorize them using perhaps words like propitiation and redemption and reconciliation and victory and ransom and so on. But there is an antiquity here. There is a line of continuity here from the Bible through the church fathers to the confessional creedal statements with regard to the purpose and function and nature of the atoning work of Jesus.
You've been listening to a message delivered at the Philadelphia Conference on Reformed Theology. This conference is a ministry of the Alliance of Confessing Evangelicals. For more messages from the PCRT, visit reformedresources.org, a trustworthy source of books, audio, video, and other resources to help you grow your Christian faith. That's reformedresources.org.